So Paul Birchall, local author. Really, I think one to unpick the journey of how do you come from I'm going to write a book to here's a book finished in front of us, you know, because that's a journey and a half, isn't it?
It is, it is. But first of all, you have to have the time and the inspiration to do it. And my grandfather, he was genuinely my hero. And I thought I would dedicate 3 years of my retirement to research his life story, his first 31 years, which is what I did. And the rest is history. Here we are with a book. I didn't realise there was so much to writing a book. Do you think when you've done your 100,000 words, that's it? It has to be edited. You have to sort out publishers and all manner of things. But it's been an experience and it's been a labour of love. And I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I got very emotional along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's led you to that? I'm going to write a book about my granddad. What led you to that first initial thought around that?
Well, it all started in my formative teenage years. I was brought up on my grandfather's farm at Manor Farm Hartshorne in South Derbyshire. And after school, I used to go round to grandfather's side of the farmhouse and have tea with him as he was losing his eyesight. He had macular dysfunction. And I used to assist with making the tea. And in that four-year period from the age of about 12 to 16, I used to sit and listen to his stories, his life stories. And naturally, as a young boy watching John Wayne war films, I tried to get some information about his time in the First World War. If I was lucky and caught him in a good mood, he would tell me snippets of stories, but invariably he used to break down in tears and get quite stroppy with me. So I had to ease these stories out of him. And I understand now, because Grandad suffered from what they now call survivor's guilt syndrome. In other words, he felt guilty for surviving, yeah. Where a lot of his friends didn't, sadly. So, sat at the farmhouse kitchen table, eating bread and jam and cups of tea. He relayed his early experiences growing up in Wiltshire. And we had a few stories about the war, which in the book I've had to sort of do from memory. They're recorded verbatim, but there is as accurate as I can be, given that there's a 50-year time lapse.
Yeah.
But they are true stories. I could have made a lot up, but I believe in honesty and integrity, and I will certainly not want to fool the reader. So there you have it. That's what inspired me. The work is for the future virtual generations. Grandad. We can claim at least 30 Birchalls who have got his DNA spanning four different generations. And at the end of the book, I thought, well, had he not survived, I wouldn't be here. So that's my thanks to him. It's a tribute to him. If he was here now, he'd frown upon me and say, why are you doing all this, Paul? Let's put it behind us, because he was such a modest man. He never, ever showed me his medals. And his citations, but I think we ought to let the local community know about this. There's so many other soldiers, as we know, were brave. A lot of people died that should have had medals, but it's a piece of metal. It's a recognition for outstanding work and bravery. But there's so many people that didn't have medals that should have had them. So it's for those as well I dedicate the book to, the fallen of both wars. So there we have it. There's me sat at the farmhouse table listening to Grandad's stories. He used to prefer to talk about his farming life, but I'm very interested in history myself. I'm very interested in the Queen Victoria era. Grandad was born in 1888, And as that era was coming to an end, I think Queen Victoria died in 1901. And it was just a very interesting period in British history and world history.
Was there anything that you, through the research for the book, because you had the stories to start from and obviously some guides to where to go, was there anything that you found out as you researched for the book that you didn't know?
Oh, of course, yes. A hint to anyone that wants to write a book about military experiences. There's a wealth of information at Kew, the National Archives, and the archives at Swindon. They're actually at Chippenham, where you can digitally get a copy of the battalion diaries on a day-to-day basis. And one story that did amuse me, and if you look at the inside cover of this book, you'll see me on the beach at Dunkirk with the Victory V sign. And that was almost 100 years to the day when Grandad would have been in Dunkirk, because in the penultimate year of the war, he had some leave, and him and his four friends went to Dunkirk. And he was late coming back. And his name, along with four other privates, is mentioned by the Major, Major Aubrey. And basically he says, for coming back late from leave, all future leave passes will be suspended until following the next day. So I wonder just what Grandad, why he was late, because Dunkirk was full of bars and brothels. I'm not saying for 1 minute Grandad misbehaved, but you could lose your innocence for 5 shillings then. And whether or not he did, we'll never know, but he would certainly not admit that to his grandson.
Well, we might have to say for people listening, shillings are old.
That's 25 pence, I think, in new money. But yes, 5 shillings. That was the going rate.
What about the sort of stories that he did tell? You sort of say that there was obviously some secrets, but what sort of key stories really stood out to you that he told you?
Well, I don't want to spoil it for the reader. I'll tell you a few. But basically, Grandad escaped death on 5 or 6 occasions. They're the occasions he told me about. The Wiltshire Yeomanry, which was a cavalry regiment, were kept in reserve, as were a lot of cavalry regiments in the first 2 years of the First World War, simply because cavalry and Maxim machine guns don't mix. Mm. And they soon found out within the first 6 months of the war that cavalry was not going to be the old traditional methods of warfare were gone for good. But General Haig kept his cavalry regiments in Britain in reserve in the hope that once a breakthrough was made, the cavalry could pursue the enemy and rout them and get a quick victory. That didn't happen because it became a stalemate. 450-odd miles of trenches were dug from the Swiss border to north of France. So the cavalry regiments, Grandad spent 2 years in Britain doing training exercises. And when he got to France in 1916, because the cavalry weren't going to be used, the Wiltshire Yeomanry were in like a support role. And Grandad volunteered to work as a in secondment to the Royal Engineers. And he was a dispatch rider, which in itself was a very risky job, because the artillery spotters and the snipers would look out for runners, messengers and dispatch riders, because anything to disrupt the line of communication was what they wanted. And on two separate occasions, Grandad, there is a picture in the book of him on his first horse. You know, he'd probably told me the name of the horse, but they all had numbers then with the regiments. But on two separate occasions, two separate horses, he had two horses collapse while he was riding them, out of just bleeding to death from shrapnel wounds. Never touched him. So shells exploded round Grandad while he was moving from the front line to the headquarters. And the horses collapsed, so he ended up with a belt drive motorbike. So that's just two near misses. I won't tell you about the main one towards the end of the book because it'll spoil it for the reader. But just to give you another example, and this is where Grandad's farming tradition probably saved his life. One evening in the trenches, his friends were sat round a makeshift stove, boiling some tea for a cup of tea. And Grandad Ernest walked past his friends. "Hello, Ernie. Are you having a cuppa with us?" He says, "I will in a bit, but I've got to go and feed and water my horse." Because there's an old saying in farming, you feed your animals before you feed yourself.
Yeah.
He walked 20 paces further on, and a shell exploded amongst his friends, and there were body bits everywhere.
Wow.
And that's how near he was. And he stayed for that cup of tea.
Mm.
So that's just three incidents. There are others in the book.
So we're sat in Woodville Community Managed Library having a nice chat about these. The stories that you're telling feel almost fantastical because of the lives that we've led, you know, and the experiences, obviously, of the people of the era of the First and Second World Wars. The story of their lives are very, very different to the story of our lives. What were people's lived experiences and how are they different to how they are now?
Well, what I've uncovered is, 110 years ago, we were a lot more religious. And we were a lot more patriotic. So many young men volunteered to fight that war before the conscription came in. And they were far more obedient to the system because it was the ruling class. I think nowadays we can watch the war as it unfolds, can't we, on Sky TV? We've witnessed that this week in Ukraine, sadly. But whole society has changed in those 110 years. We've become less religious. We now find ourselves questioning authority a lot more. 110 years ago, the state took control of the press and the media. The public were drip-fed information about what was happening in the war. It was all positive information. It was never negative. Now, I think the press have got a lot more freedom now.
Yeah.
And that's the significant difference to me. Social and health reform. Back 110 years ago, people were drinking water out of springs that were contaminated by raw sewage. And in Grandad's early life, that all changed. You know, people started to live longer. Families were big families because invariably two or three infants died before the age of five. But sanitation improved, the sewer system of Britain. This is all mentioned in the book, but there were massive advancements in health reform and the social changes as well. A lot of the working class young men that volunteered for this war were lucky to have one decent meal a day, and it was noted that within 6 months of joining the army, some of them grew an inch and a half in height because they were having, you know, a proper balanced diet or something resembling that. And that was very sad. It struck me as very sad. And we don't have that now, do we? The Army and Navy, the forces always have supplied good food when circumstances permit. But it's the social deprivation. And a lot of young men joined the war out of sheer patriotism, but a lot of them joined to have three square meals a day, which to them was a luxury.
Yeah.
And we tend to forget that. So the social and welfare reform, the woman's rights over this period changed dramatically. towards the end of the war, women were promised the vote. I think they had to be over 30. And there was actually a Member of Parliament elected the year the war ended. I just forget her name now, but she wasn't allowed to appear in Parliament as the first woman because she was in jail, having been convicted of suffragette, anti-conscript riots. I just forget the name. I ought to know the name for the listener, but it's in the book. And it's the social and welfare reforms and health and technology. If you read the book, there's a lot of interesting facts about discovering blood groups, techniques in surgery. And it's a fact that in that four-year period of World War One, the advancements in medical and surgical techniques and drugs were more rapid than at any other time before or since the First World War. So it was a period of significant change. But sadly, the horrors of the war eclipsed some of that. So, yeah, it's been a real journey.
So as you say, the two paths are the story of your granddad's sort of life and career and you know, the events that happened to him, but also almost a commentary of how life changed.
Oh, yes.
over the period of time that you're looking at, which is brilliant.
What I tried to do in the book is pay tribute to all the different parts of society that contributed to that war. The women that went in the armaments industry that they call the canaries. You know why they call them the canaries? Because some of the constituents of high explosives used to make their hands go yellow. So they were called canaries.
That's the current book?
Yeah.
And you mentioned that that's the first 31 years...
of his life.
Of his life.
Yeah.
Does that mean you've got a few years in you for the next 30 years?
Well, to date, I've had some real positive feedback from people that have read the book. And that might inspire me to do the remainder of his life. Because Grandad was born in 1888 and he died in 1977. So there's probably 50 more years to cover.
Two books.
Yes, and it spanned another world war.
Of course.
And in Grandad's second half of his life, he had a farm in Market Harborough with 600 Italian prisoners of war during Second World War. So there are some more interesting stories.
Book number two. Yeah.
So book number two might come along, and I might even write some of my memoirs, but I'm not sure about that. There's an Official Secrets Act and some sensitive police techniques that I wouldn't be able to divulge.
Yeah. Have you always wanted to write a book?
When I was a young boy at Granville School, and I'm proud to say that I was a member of, I was a Granville Scholar, 1971 to 1976. I used to write lovely essays in English. I think I came top of the class in year one. But the teacher used to make me stand up and read the stories. But afterwards, with me being slightly dyslexic, I used to have to put right all the spelling mistakes. So I used to end up staying behind in lunch break doing all my spelling mistakes. And this is something to inspire would-be writers in the future. Don't let dyslexia stop you from doing it, because I've managed to get through 30 years in the police force, you know, doing Crown Court files for trial. And you've always got spell check, haven't you, on Microsoft Word? Some of my colleagues at work would say I'm acutely dyslexic, but I'd say I was mildly.
Somebody listen to this, either because we've got a few international listeners from Canada and other places, or local to Woodville, they can come into the library. We've definitely got a copy here.
Yep.
We have more copies here, potentially. To be able to sell for you. It's available on Amazon?
Yes.
Where else would people get hold of
it? I have self-published through a company in Wiltshire called Riverside Publishing Solutions. So a copy can be purchased from them. We've mentioned Amazon Books. I'm going to do a, like a promotion locally in Northwest Leicestershire and South Derbyshire through magazines that are delivered to the doorstep.
Yep.
So the Magic Attic in Swaddling Coat is going to be one place of distribution. Hermitage FM near Colville, that's going to be another. I'm going to sort out some other distribution locations. So hopefully it will be available to whoever would like to purchase the book.
Have you got plans to do anything with it with digital publishing? Because obviously we've got a hard copy in front of us here. Are you thinking about e-books or audiobooks?
It is available on e-book.
Right. Is that the Amazon?
Through Amazon,
that's
yeah.
That's Amazon, okay, yeah.
I may, if I can afford it, do an audio version. Perhaps you could help me with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's it. Get him recorded saying yes, and then you're guaranteed.
My mate Chris. Yeah. But yes, I'm sure it will appeal to... I want to stress that it's the appeal won't be just to would-be soldiers or people that are interested in military history. There's a lot of history covering 40 years, just under 40 years in this book. So I'd like to think it would appeal to a broad spectrum. Young people wanting to find out a bit of history of this period, not just military. I've tried not to make it just a military First World War book because there are so many of these books.
Yeah,
this will appeal because there's all other aspects of life in the Victorian era. And the first part of the book covers Grandad's childhood, which I hope will appeal to a broader reader.
I mean, it's a fascinating period anyway. Mm. I think I'm the same as you. It's not something you cover a lot in school or anything, but when you start breaking down and thinking about the different time periods, a sort of 1880s to 1920 is, as you say, when the world changed. There was so much went from analogue. It's almost like the original analogue to digital sort of change of... Things were this way. Cavalry is a great example. We did something this way for the last 2,000 years. Suddenly, we've now got to find a different way of doing things in the next 6 months.
Yeah. There are things that happened then that are still the impact is being felt today. Problems in China and Taiwan, the distrust between the Western nations and China. People forget. But if you go back in history, and it's mentioned in this book, the Boxer Rebellions around 1900s. Japan, America, and countries from Western Europe, including Britain, occupied over half of China with the sole intention of probably getting the mineral resources and what else they could get out of the country.
Yeah.
And the Chinese haven't forgotten that and never will do.
No.
And at the beginning of the war, this is a real dirty trick. Again, it's in the book. At the beginning of the war, the Empress Dowager supplied 140,000 Chinese labourers to go on the Western Front. And they are unsung heroes because they did all the road repairs, trench building... burying of bodies, which was about the worst job you could ever have. Taking water supplies and food supplies to the frontline troops. And Empress Dowager was promised by Britain that if Britain won this conflict, they would return vast amounts of territory that Germany and her allies occupied in China. This is fact. This is not fiction. So she supplied these 140,000 labourers. Unbeknown to the Chinese, the British had done a double deal with the Japanese government. And they basically said to Japan, if you come into the war on our side and help us supply your merchant ships, were badly needed because of the U-boat campaign, if we are successful, the successful outcome of this war... we will let you have the territory that the Germans occupy and their allies. So it was a double deal. Now, that was 110 years ago. But the Chinese are going to have that memory in their minds. You came and occupied our country, and you're falling out with us over Taiwan. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute China should be allowed to occupy Taiwan.
But there's historic complications.
And bad feeling over what we have done in our colonial past.
It's a big old mess when you go back and look at
that's it. That's the thing, isn't it? It is such a... Even as you've alluded to already with what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, there's so many complexities to all of it that, you know, your immediate human thing is to say, all war is bad, peace is the answer. But history is really complicated, and it's not quite as simple as that. You can have that value and that...
Sometimes war is unavoidable. Mm. Just take, for instance, the Boer War, which was about 13 years before the First World War. We invented concentration camps. It was our idea. Hitler copied it. We interned the Boer families and children in the hope that they would surrender quicker. And it did bring about, you know, it did shorten the war, I would say. I mean, historians can argue that with me. But we did some nasty things. And there's some things that this country shouldn't be proud of.
I mean, people will say nowadays, well, you can't put a modern lens on things. And there are certain things you can't put a modern lens on. Going into a country, decimating it, killing lots of people, you either know that that's right or wrong. That doesn't need a change in history and a way of thinking to understand that in the 1880s, multiple countries from Europe going into Africa and carving up the continent as they saw fit was blatantly not right.
Yeah,
and you could tell that sending people across oceans in boats as slaves, you know that's not right.
I mean, it could be argued that the envy that Kaiser Wilhelm had with his two cousins, the Tsar of Russia and our king, he was envious of the achievements and the colonial territory that we'd got in our two empires. And he wanted an empire for Germany. And the industrialists in Germany and the military encouraged that envy.
Right.
And that's what spurned him into all his aggression.
People wanted to make money out of other people's misery. That doesn't sound like the way the world works.
Yeah, yeah. But, maybe that's, you know, because... I think we can travel down a hole here for a long time, but I think the answer is you know, probably money and probably land and probably material
it's all
things.
About materialistic stuff. Yeah. There's a very good when we've been just talking through this. I watched the Kingsman. Other films are available. very recently, the new one with
Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah, and that's got that in it. It bases that around this period. Starts off and there's a scene in the Boer War that then moves to the First World War, and it talks about the relationship between the three cousins who were Britain, Russia and Germany at the time.
So, well, while you talk about Ralph Fiennes, early part of the book tells you what the cavalry regiment was doing in Britain, and they go, I think they do a trek from Wiltshire to Winchester College. And the graduates there are called Wycombeists. And Grandad and his cavalry were stationed there and the horses were tethered up in the cloisters and they stayed there for 2 or 3 weeks. And it's mentioned in the Wycombeist magazine. And there's some quite famous scholars, Wycombeists, one of whom was Ralph Fiennes and his brothers. And I think the current Chancellor of the Exchequer, is it Rishi Sunak?
Okay.
I don't know how you pronounce his words. He was a Wycombeist. But what really got to the... that the guy in charge was heartbroken because 300 or 400 Wycombeists who volunteered for the First World War never came back, and he was heartbroken.
Yeah.
But there's a nice bit of history there because that college was also a billet for the Roundhead cavalry regiments in the British Civil War. So there's a nice little bit of history there. When the Wiltshire yeomans leave Winchester College, the farrier puts a horseshoe in the brickwork, obviously embedded into mortar, and there's a plaque saying the Wiltshire Yeomans were here from this date to this date, and there's a horseshoe in the wall, and that's there to this day. Yeah,
so
a bit of history there, bit of history.
So I've got one closing question, which is from your process, and this is quite an open question, of writing the book, of finding out all the information, of you know, retelling the stories, of going through the process of having put the words down, then the route of publishing it, and you know, to the physical products that we see in front of us today. What one piece of key learning have you got from that that you'd sort of pass on to other people who are either aspiring writers or aspiring historians or whatever?
What I'm saying is, with modern technology, the internet and the World Wide Web, the information is there. I didn't think I would get enough material to do. I aimed for a 100,000 word book. I found it quite easy towards the end, because you just got to know how to interrogate the World Wide Web, because the information's there. And just the lesson I've learned is there's so much help out there from libraries, museums. There's so many people that want to help you. And just a tip for anybody who wants to write a book similar to mine, just look at the acknowledgements at the end of my book, and you'll see just to what extent you can go to get the help. And what I'd like to do, I'd like people to feel a bit sad, albeit it's got a really happy ending. But I hope it inspires people to research their grandparents, their father, and the grandparents' part that they played in the two horrible, tragic wars. So I hope it inspires people to look back in history. And if they want to do likewise, then they can.